with an angel and had a good time. I dreamed I was satisfied and nothing to worry about mine, but that's just a dream. Just a dream I had on my mind. I played policy and played the horses too. I dreamed I'd win so much money, I didn't know what to do, but that was just a dream. Just a dream I had on my mind.
December 23rd, 1938, Carnegie Hall, and you were there. You also might have heard Sister Rosetta Tharpe, Billie Holiday. Who else was there?
Sidney Bechet.
Sidney Bechet.
Count Basie.
Count Basie. And you just heard, well, you just heard Bob Reisman, our guest, and what you just heard musically was Big Bill Brunzi making his Carnegie Hall and probably New York City debut, December 23rd, 1938, the great John Hammond, who went on to keep discovering people, including a guy named Bob Dylan and another guy named Bruce Springsteen. And if you've ever had a chance to see or hear interviews with John Hammond, that's amazing, the late John Hammond, amazing as well. This was from Spirituals to Swing, and that was Big Bill Brunzi, who had created the song, or at least premiered it just for that moment. It was just a dream. Welcome back to Critical Thinking. I'm your host and producer for this series, Andrew Patner, and this is part two of a two, it looks like it's going to be a three-part series of conversations with Bob Reisman, the author of the book, I Feel So Good, The Life and Times of Big Bill Brunzi, 2011, University of Chicago Press, and a paperback in print as well now in 2013. Reisman is spelled R-I-E-S-M-A-N, and it occurs to me some of you may not know how to spell Big Bill Brunzi, B-R-O-O-N-Z-Y. So we last week, Bob, talked about the career from the very beginning of the 20th century, coming up from Arkansas to Chicago, going from country fiddling into blues guitar singing and composition of all of that, and then how the 20s economically and so on, the 20s and the 30s, how these things affect him, where he moves and so on. But here he comes to a point not only of appreciation, but a point of, and therefore exposure, but also a point of change in the reception of music and then the opportunities that that provides. So we went up to him appearing there. What happened at the concert and what's the reception and What are the reviews, criticism, and where does he go from there?
The appearance that Big Bill made at the From Spirituals to Swing concert of 1938 was truly a pivot point in his career. There was what he presented and what he recognized that he was capable of. He had come from Chicago, where at that point in his career, there were not very many venues. There was starting to be an increasing number, but there weren't very many venues in Chicago for him to perform. There weren't the kind of blues clubs that really grew up and expanded through the 50s and 60s and beyond. He was lucky to be playing tiny taverns. And here's Big Bill standing on the stage of the most prestigious concert venue in America. And he's equipped with only his voice, his guitar, his songwriting ability, and his charisma. And as the recording captures, he literally swept the crowd off of its feet. What you can hear is the increasing level of engagement. It's wonderful that there's a live recording of the From Spirituals to Swing concert. And by the time in particular where Bill gets to the verse where he imagines himself in the White House, the crowd is captivated. And so what Bill recognized in that moment was that he was capable of, just as a solo acoustic performer, going into places wholly unlike any he had been before and becoming and having that be successful. And that really became, not immediately, it took the better part of a decade or so, but that wound up being the trajectory of the last dozen or so years of his career, and brought him success, prominence, and brought the blues to places that it hadn't been in the way it was before. And beyond that, just to make one more point, it was nothing short of an audacious image that he presented. Here is an African-American musician standing at Carnegie Hall imagining an African-American man in the White House.
Right.
Think about the context for this. This is 1938. It will be 10 years before Truman issues an executive order desegregating the armed forces.
Right.
This is an America which is very different from the America that we know today in many significant respects. And for Bill to present that song in that setting to that audience is really, to me, an extraordinary artistic accomplishment and political statement. It just so happens that he was about 70 years early as a prophet.
Well, and remember, too, A. Philip Randolph has already begun planning the March on Washington a few years before that, which is not realized until 1963. Right. But he has planned it then, because it's about not just equality, but employment. And so it's a ripe time, as you say. Who are some of the people in that audience, and what are some of the written recollections or reviews of the evening?
It was covered in the New York Times, in the Herald Tribune, in the papers of record of the day. In some ways, the most significant seed that was planted that day was in the mind of a young, reasonably young, Alan Lomax, who was in attendance there. It, in all likelihood, almost certainly, was the first time that Alan Lomax had heard Big Bill Brunze perform. Now, by this time, Alan Lomax was in his mid-20s, and he had already been through several wonderfully fertile collecting trips for songs and other material with his father,
John Lomax.
And he had been he was poised on the brink of becoming the assistant in charge of the Archive of American Folk Song. And he saw Big Bill that day, and that was a connection that again bore fruit about half a dozen or so years later, in the years just after the end of World War II. But it was, it turned out to be one of the more important professional connections that Bill made during the course of his career.
I mean, it's really, it's It's a history-making connection from every direction for Lomax, for Big Bill, and for all of us who have continued to benefit from the work that each of them did. We come now to something that seems quite different, at least from what we've been hearing, 1941. And I don't want to judge it. I want you to set it up and listen.
The next selection is a song called Why Don't You Do Right? And the singer that you'll hear is Lil Green. Lil had she was at that time recording. She was born in Mississippi. She came to Chicago and had actually not had a very long performing career at that point. It had really been from the late 1930s, really a couple of years before. But she had recorded in a quartet that included Big Bill on guitar. I recorded a song called Romance in the Dark. It's still it's a standard often referred to as In the Dark. And what's noteworthy about this song is it is a terrific example of Bill's versatility. Unlike what we just heard from Carnegie Hall and on other previous recordings, Bill is now playing an electric guitar. And he's also playing in a very different style. He's backing a singer as opposed to being the lead force musically. And what you can hear is the way in which he has mastered a new instrument and a new style of playing on what has become a standard for many, many years.
You had plenty of money in 1922, but you let other women make a fool of you. Why don't you do right like some other men do? Get out of here and get me some money too. You sitting down wondering what it's all about. If you ain't got no money, they going to put you out. Why don't you do right like some other men do? Get out of here and get me some money too. If you had prepared 20 years ago, you wouldn't have been drifting from door to door. Why don't you do right like some other men do? Get out of here and get me some money too.
Big Bill Brunze, as you've heard him in a completely different way, or you may very well have heard that recording and not realized that you were also hearing Big Bill. Once you know you're hearing him, though, backing Lil Green and with colleagues on that great song, Why Don't You Do Right, that was a hit for Peggy Lee and many other singers. And when you mentioned In the Dark, a great friend of this program was the late Bobby Short, and he loved Little Green Stuff, and he loved that song in particular. Would bring out all kinds of shading socially as well as musically and lyrically in that. This guy could have been a guitar virtuoso. Not that he shouldn't have done all the other great things that he did, but, I mean, it's almost supernatural, his connection with the instrument.
What he did at multiple points in his career was to approach the instrument as it was at that time in popular music or in its evolution and find a way to make it his own. And what's, I think, noteworthy is the way in which he was able to do that in so many different styles,
right,
and genres and in different roles. It's one thing to be the lead figure, and it's another one to find a way to support the lead figure in a way that will enhance that performance.
And it's not a case of somebody who is down on his luck and has to do something like sweeping the floor or playing the drums for this session. This is something he's doing as an artistic colleague. This is a time, too, when other people are picking up that instrument or bringing that instrument to wider attention. Charlie Christian with and integrating Benny Goodman's band, Django Reinhardt, of course. But there's still this, and I mean this in a very good way, there's still this country picking feel that Big Bill is bringing in at the same time that he's even almost, I don't want to say mocking, but he's having fun at the end there with that kind of supper club arpeggio, just rising notes there. So now, speaking of being a colleague or backing somebody up, it's not just with somebody in the jazz pop world, but here's a collaboration with Sonny Boy Williamson. Now, we should clarify which Sonny Boy Williamson,
right,
because there were two.
Right. This is a song that was a John Lee Williamson, who became known as Sonny Boy Number One, more retroactively once Rice Miller arrived on the scene a number of years later and identified himself as Sonny Boy Williamson. But John Lee Williamson was a friend and colleagues of musical colleague of Big Bill's, really from fairly early on in John Lee Williamson's recording career, which began in the late 1930s. Bill played on dozens of Sonny Boy's songs, and it's notable for Bill that, as you said, he was both a front man. I mean, there were many, many, many records out with Big Bill. That was literally, when you go to the 78s, that's how he was known. They didn't put Brunzi on it.
Really? Just Big Bill?
Just Big Bill.
Right.
Up until a certain point,
right,
in his career. So he's not only the front man, the lead figure as Big Bill, but he was also a first call session guitarist, primarily in Chicago, because so much blues recording in the late 30s and early 40s was being done in Chicago. And it was not just for Sonny Boy. Now, Sonny Boy was a big recording star, as was Lil Green, as were people whose name, a set of artists, I'll mention a few,
please,
whose names are less known even to blues fans because they were recording in an era that preceded the era of the tremendous prominence that the artists at Chess, for example, particularly in the 1950s and 60s got. And they deserve that prominence. But their success was built on a foundation that Bill and his colleagues had laid down. And
right,
so Bill played on just about every of the 160 songs that Washboard Sam recorded.
Mm-hmm.
Bill was playing guitar. Many of the songs that Jazz Gillum recorded. Many of the songs that Merlene Johnson, the Yes, Yes Girl, recorded. So the point is that Bill, there was a financial incentive.
Sure.
He got paid something to be a session guitarist. Bill maintained that it was years and years. It really wasn't until the 1950s that he was able to make enough of a living out of the music business that he was able to give up a day job. He was working day jobs. At the time, he was both a star and a very active session guitarist.
What sort of day jobs was he working in the late 30s, early to mid-40s?
It's hard to find specific documentation. He mentioned, or he wrote at one point that to Alan Lomax that he worked in the merchandise mart. And I guess it was probably in some kind of maintenance capacity at that time. It was probably a time where there was money for any number of either private or public enterprises that might have been housed there. And so there was both this financial incentive, but beyond that, it was his it's a link to the world, to his first musical training, which in Arkansas, which was playing in a black string band. And these were ensembles with acoustic instruments, of course, early 20th century, generally guitar, some combination of guitar, banjo, fiddle, bass, and maybe mandolin. And what Bill, his training there was to both shine as the lead performer when it was his turn to step up as the fiddle player, and then to back up each of the other players because they needed dancers that will be satisfied and would pay to continue to bring the band on. And so that quality of being able to make another performer, to enhance the quality of another performer's musicianship is one thing that this song will illustrate very well.
Mellow Chick Swing, Sonny Boy Williamson, and Big Bill Brunsey.
She kind of fine, she changed my mind. I want some wine and take her time. I know you is kind of slick, but I'm hipper to this mellow chick. Sit down and think, I can't get a drink. Let her have her way, she know what to say. I know she is kind of slick, but I'm hipper to this mellow chick. I got a way. Been blowing gauge. Don't know what to say. Can't have my way. I know she is kind of slick, but hipper to this little mellow chick. All right, John. Get my clothes. You done put my doors. Say you didn't want me no more. You love me to so and so. I know you is kind of slick, but I've got a hipper to this melody. I don't know when. Come back to your house again. Give me my chains. Running around with this man. I know you is kind of slick, but I've got a hipper to this melody. I got it myself, John.
Sonny Boy Williamson, Blind John Davis, and Big Bill, of course, was Big Bill Brunsey. And wow, there's 1947, and he's playing for a black audience, so we know that somewhere out there maybe young Chuck Berry is listening, but I think somebody's got Bill Haley's white head up to the radio, too. He's invented rock and roll avant la lettre. I mean, it's just unbelievable. We're speaking with Bob Reisman, who spent what, 15 years?
10 years.
10 years. Oh, let's just keep making it 10 years.
You can round it up.
Right? 10 years working on this remarkable book, and we're giving you a sort of musicalized walkthrough of that book, I Feel So Good, The Life and Times of Big Bill Brunsie, University of Chicago Press, out in hardcover and paperbound with wonderful photographs as well. We'll put some of them up on the website. We're mentioning and giving examples of this simultaneous at this point period, performing for and playing for black audiences, having been presented to an overwhelmingly white audience at Carnegie Hall in 1938, and now coming into a period where he has definitely got his foot firmly in both worlds. And we've mentioned Alan Lomax. There's also a gentleman who is inextricably tied in from this point on with Big Bill Brunsie, and that's a fellow named Louis Studs Terkel. And this is a few years before WFMT that they come together, and the stories are wonderful and told both in Bob's book and in some of the film and video that he leads you to in the appendices of that book. So they're going to set up an introduction to this, but at least we can set up an introduction to the introduction.
Right. It was in the years after World War II that there was an organization formed in New York City called People's Songs. And People's Songs was led by Pete Seeger. Alan Lomax was involved. Woody Guthrie was involved. And Studs Terkel was also involved. And it was a way for artists who wanted to devote their artistic talents in the service of social causes they felt strongly about, particularly fighting for strong unions and fighting against racial injustice. And one of the ways in which they would gather, both attract new members and motivate the existing membership, was to have hootenannies, or what they called hoots. They even wrote a little handbook on how to run a successful hoot, because there were branches. It was formed in New York City, but it went to Chicago and other places. And so it was at a People's Songs hoot in Chicago, or several of them perhaps, that Big Bill met probably first Win Strachey, because Win was performing, because he was a performer, and then not long after that, Studs Terkel. And so it turns out that Bill's connection with both Win and Studs extended, it was a close one, both personally and professionally, extended through the end of Bill's life till he died in 1958. And so the song that you'll hear next is a song that Bill performed in that period, in the years right after World War II. It's called Black, Brown, and White Blues. It is as much of an anthem as Bill ever wrote. And it demonstrates, again, his skill as a songwriter, where he presents in each verse vignettes of racial prejudice and then comes to a chorus, which is a catchy, singable chorus. So those who wish to mobilize against this can be motivated by Black, Brown, and White Blues.
And you'll know, if one, you may know the song already from years of airplay here on WFMT. You may also know the central idea from what was a controversial benediction by Reverend Joseph Lowry at Barack Obama, President Obama's first inauguration, where he quoted, if not the song, the sentiment and the phrasing. Do you know if he was referring to the song or just more to what was said, which was one of the phrases that leads into Bill creating the song?
It's certainly a credible notion that Reverend Joseph Lowry, veteran of many civil rights, much of the civil rights struggle, could well have come across Bill's song. The phrases and the phrasing, particularly the phrases, were part of African-American discourse prior to that. Zora Neale Hurston had referred to some of the phrases in some of her work. But the fact is, it converged at the inauguration of the first African-American president.
When did you write Black, Brown, and White?
Well, I wrote Black, Brown, and White in 1939, it was. Well, I started singing in 1939 because I was working at a foundry at that time. And, well, I was molder. Well, I went from a bench molder to a floor molder, making different patterns, make things out of it. And it was, they hired a fella there and put him to work with me. And he worked with me for about, I guess, around a month. And then he got to be the boss there. And that's why, and he would tell me what to do after that. After I learned him what I know, then he got to be the boss there. And so then he was telling me how I should do these things. So after that, I just wrote a song. For fact, it's written about my life. A lot of people don't like it because of the word, get back. Well, it's a lot of people in the world have never had to get back. But I wrote it because I had to get back. This little song that I'm singing about, people you know it's true. If you black and gotta work for a living now, this is what they would say to you. This is, if you was white, you'd be all right. If you was brown, stick around. But as you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back. I was in a place one night, they was all having fun. They was all buying beer and wine, but they would not sell me none. They said, if you was white, you'd be all right. If you was brown, you'd stick around. But as you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back. They went to employ me at office, the number I got in line. They called everybody's number, but they never did call mine. They said, if you was white, you'd be all right. If you was brown, stick around. But as you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back. Me and a man is working side by side. This is what it meant. They was paying him $1 an hour, and they was paying me 50 cents. They said, if you was white, you'd be all right. If you was brown, stick around. But as you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back. I hope built this country, and I fought for it too. Now guess that you can see what a black man have to do. He says, if you was white, she's all right. If you was brown, stick around. But as you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back. I hope win sweet victory with my little plying hoe. Now I want you to tell me, brother, what you gonna do about the old Jim Crow. Now if you's white, she's all right. If you's brown, stick around. But if you's black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back.
So there, just with voice and acoustic guitar, you have personal experience, message, wonderful song written, wonderful singing, speaking, narration, amazing guitar work, and all of it blends into a unity. And that's kind of Big Bill right there in a nutshell. So some archaeological questions, Bob. Did he write the song in 1939? When was that recording with Studs Terkel? And I am guessing that if he did write the song in 39, he added those later verses about the experience of black men coming back from the Second World War and facing unemployment, Jim Crow, and everything else. And take it away.
Okay. Bill may have written the song, or at least some verses, in 1939. The first time I'm aware that he performed it was in 1946 at a People's Songs concert in New York City that Alan Lomax organized, and it met with a wonderfully positive reception. It was Virgil Thompson, known for being a classical music critic, wrote glowingly about it, as did other reviewers. And it then became part of Bill's repertoire very much from that point forward. That particular recording was made in a studio in WFMT, I believe,
right.
Actually, with Studs in the mid-1950s, I think 1956.
Right. So my guess is it's when they were still on the west side, because we heard a lot of street noise and other noise, which when they were in – I don't mean that in a bad way. I'm just saying that once they were in high-rise buildings, they might not have heard. They could have been at LaSalle and Wacker, but it sounded to me like maybe they were still at the Hotel Guyon where Bernie and Rita Jacobs started the station and where Studs started working. And, of course, there we also just hear, one, this amazing speaking voice that he had, and also this amazing gift of language and communication that he has.
All of which very much true. This was also in a period from the late 40s on into the 1950s where Bill was very mindful. He had to be very mindful of the settings in which he would record and perform this song. This was a period that, as he would have been very well aware of, Paul Robeson got in a tremendous level of difficulty with the American government. Josh White had made what turned out to be a dreadful mistake in volunteering to testify in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee. Things went quite badly at that point. Alan Lomax traveled over to Europe and was based primarily in England and traveled around elsewhere as part of recording projects for most of the 1950s. So Bill was very mind – Pete Seeger with the Weavers. Weavers had tremendous success in 1950, and several years later they had to disband because of blacklisting.
And Studs was on the radio because he was blacklisted from being an actor on the radio when Strachey faced this. I mean, just about everybody he knew.
Right, right. Studs, as Studs put it once, Studs was quietly graylisted.
Right, right.
In losing the TV show.
Right.
Wynn was very much specifically blacklisted. So Bill, as was characteristic of him, made an assessment of the circumstances in which he found himself and picked and chose his spots. The first time he recorded this song commercially was when he had made his first trip to Europe in 1951. He recorded it for French Vogue Records. In September of 1951, and that was, I'm certain, a very conscious choice on his part.
I also can't help but think about both with this cast of characters, but also the very similar setting where the most known recording that I can think of is done in an interview conversation, in this case with Alan Lomax. I'm thinking of Leadbelly's Bourgeois Blues. Where does that fit in chronologically? Do you know? I should
have checked. That predates. Well,
yeah,
I believe it was 1944.
Yeah,
that's
it's
somewhere in that region. It predates. But mentioning Leadbelly in the same breath as Big Bill makes an awful lot of sense. They performed together along with Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie at one of the People's Songs, Hoots.
Wouldn't you have loved to have been there?
If someone had had some kind of recording device to capture that, that's something of a holy grail.
I mean, those really it is. These are the four giants of these movements. I mean,
And Leadbelly lived with his wife Martha in New York City. He was based in New York City for periods of time in that era. Leadbelly's niece, Tiny Robinson, recalls Big Bill coming over to the house along with Josh White and along with Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee, all of whom were very active in the People's Songs movement.
Right. Amazing. Amazing stuff. And, of course, a major role with all of those people. And you've heard even in recent years now that we have the Best of Studs Terkel, and also now, thank goodness, that the Library of Congress is restoring not only those programs you already know of Studs, but programs we've not been able to play for a long time because they haven't been in the right condition. And we just had a wonderful Sonny and Brownie, Sonny Terry, Brownie McGee program that I had no recollection of having heard that's now in – it sounds as if they're in the studio right now. These digital restorations are so pristine. So how is it then that Big Bill goes off to Europe, and what – who's involved with this? What are his hopes? What are his intentions? And what happens when he gets there?
Big Bill made his first trip to Europe in the summer of 1951. And there were two people who were responsible for making this happen. One of them was Win Strachey, and the other was the leading figure in the French jazz world in that time, a gentleman named Hugues Panassier. Panassier, along with others, particularly Charles Delaunay, had put together a network in the years before World War II that was organized under the rubric of being the Hot Club of France, and then that extended to other areas in the years leading up to World War II, break for World War II, and then picked up again after that. What that meant was there was a knowledgeable and passionate audience for jazz in Europe. That actually dates back to the years immediately following World War I. Sidney Bechet played overseas in 1919. Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong toured Europe in the 1930s to large and appreciative crowds. But after the hiatus for the war, the performers started to return. And from Panassier's perspective, and he was a prolific writer and an eloquent speaker, and so he had tremendous influence, the roots of jazz, or the finest jazz, the most authentic jazz, was New Orleans jazz. But the roots of that was the blues.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that people had listened to most of the – had become familiar with most of the jazz performers and the blues performers was through 78 records. And so there were exchanges through the mail. There were also some service – some U.S. servicemen stationed particularly in England who would bring over the 78. So the 78s was really the currency. It was the digital file of its time. And so – Panassier was corresponding with Win Strachey, and we should say a few words about Win Strachey very briefly.
Please.
As when Win died in 1991, Studs Terkel wrote his obituary, and the opening line reads, "Win Strachey was my oldest friend."
Mm-hmm.
And Win had been born in Kansas. His father was a minister. He came to the north side of Chicago in Old Town. Win grew up on the north side and
in that very German-American environment that was Chicago and that was the near north side and St. Michael's Church and and so on as the parish. Yeah.
Right, which then played a role in the story of folk music a few years later, as we'll come to. And Win attended Senn High School, he attended Lake Forest College, and then he traveled in the mid-1920s to the west, to Wyoming, where he met a miner named Flatwheel Harry. Flatwheel Harry was also a member of the IWW, the International, the Industrial Workers of the World, who used songs as a way to mobilize and to set forth their case for their cause. And that was a transformative experience for Win. He became aware of the songs of the American frontier, and there was a political awareness that he picked up from that. He came back. He was a wonderful singer. He was a classically trained singer.
With a rich, rich bass baritone.
Claudia Cassidy reviewed a recital that Win gave in the late 1950s, and she spoke of his beautiful voice and said that he would have been cherished on the opera stages and in the recital halls if he'd chosen to move in that direction. And he made his living for a number of years, particularly in the 1930s, singing hymns of all churches on the air radio station in Chicago. And where Win met Studs Terkel was in a group called the Chicago Repertory Group in the late
1930s. Which is also where Studs and Ida Terkel met.
Right.
Ida Goldberg then.
And this was an entity that was it started out as the Chicago Workers Theater. It became the Rep Group as the 30s went along. And this was a group of artists who wanted to devote their talents in the service of plays, as they called it, of social significance. And so Studs later described it as effectively guerrilla theater in some cases. They would go to where we're in union halls where workers were mobilizing. They would go to settings where workers were on strike. And they would perform plays such as Waiting for Lefty, several Clifford
Odets
plays.
This was the Chicago outpost of the work that Clifford Odets and others were doing, really.
And it got very good reviews.
Right,
if you look at
the
contemporary reviews,
these
were effective dramatic performances with a political message. And so that's where Wynn met Studs. In the years so they performed in the late 30s into the early 40s. In the as the war broke out, many of these individuals went off to serve in the armed forces in various ways. And then in the years after the war, they came together, particularly Wynn and Studs, and where they met Big Bill was then through people's songs.
Right.
And at this point, and we'll maybe jumping a little bit ahead, but there was a singing group, a review that Wynn and Studs and Big Bill and a set of other Chicago-based performers put together for the first time in 1947 called the I Come For to Sing Review. And it was in that mechanism whereby their opening night was at Mandel Hall at the University of Chicago. And the format was Studs was the narrator Big Bill would sing blues. He would define a category. He'd say, let's sing songs about work. Let's sing songs about travel. We're going to perform songs about love. And Wynn would sing songs of the American frontier. A tenor named Larry Lane would sing songs of, as Studs says, of the Elizabethan era. And Big Bill would sing blues, and Studs would tie it all together. And as Studs said of the opening night at Mandel Hall, something electrifying happened. It really resonated with the audience. So they began to perform locally, then regionally. They would go to college campuses. And then in the early 1950s, they got a residency at the most prestigious jazz club in the Loop in Chicago, the Blue Note. But to step back, to bring us back to where how Big Bill got to Europe, all of that needed to be told to explain why Wynn Strachey was corresponding with Upinassier and why Wynn was in a position to make the recommendation that he did.
Right. We wouldn't know, though Wynn was involved with so many things and interest in everything, we wouldn't normally associate him as the representative of jazz in Chicago or a French collector and presenter.
Right. Right. But he had a wonderful collection of Bessie Smith records, so he was passionate as so many were. So Panassier and Wynn were corresponding about records, and Panassier said, I'd like to bring a blues performer over to European audiences who would be good. And because Wynn had been performing night after night on a regular basis with Big Bill in front of predominantly white audiences and saw how well consistently Bill had done, Wynn was in the position to say, you should bring Big Bill Brunzi. And what Wynn said afterwards to someone who was requesting information about Wynn's life, he said, if you'd like to say something good about me, please note that I was the person that recommended Big Bill go to Europe.
Baby, you know that's all I can say is hey. lost your good thing now. Yeah, you've lost your good thing now. You had me fooled, but I found it out somehow.
Not Jack Brickhouse, a different Hey Hey. Bob Reichman, tell us about that song.
This was a song that is noteworthy in particular because it appeared in a documentary that was made about Big Bill when he got over to Europe. He arrived. His first trip was in 1951, where he toured in France. He toured in Germany and in England. In succeeding trips, when he was primarily based in France, he met a Belgian couple, Yannick and Margot Brunog, both of whom were jazz fans, both of whom were part of the Panassier, the U Panassier network of hot clubs, and they. Yannick, in fact, was delegated by U Panassier when Bill literally first set foot on European soil in July of 1951. It was Yannick who met him at the airport in Brussels. And so they were serving really as unpaid managers to Bill because they could tap into the hot club network. They could get him gigs, and they made sure that he was properly paid and his accommodations were decent. And they got to know him in the course of working with him. And Bill was a remarkable raconteur and was often pleased to have an audience for his who would be appreciative of his stories. And so as he told of his life and his colleagues and his music to Yannick and Margot, they said, we should really be documenting this. We should be capturing this in some way. One of the ways that they did that was to make a to produce a 17-minute documentary. And as Margot, who's still very much with us, says, we needed to spice it up a little bit. It couldn't just be one camera focusing on Big Bill. There needed to be a little story so it would get some kind of distribution and broadcast. And so they filmed Big Bill in a Brussels jazz club, and he's a solo performer. And there's a little story of him flirting with a young woman there. It's atmospheric. It's very much of the European cinema of the time. Mm-hmm. Yannick actually had a show on Belgian TV where he showed film. So he was knowledgeable about this, and they had a writer and a director involved. But what happened then was one of these wonderful cross-cultural explosions. It was the film was shown on British TV in, say, 55, 56, right around then. And watching British TV in that period was, among others, a generation of British teenagers for whom TV was an exciting new medium. And so there was a set of these British teenagers who watched this performance for whom this was a transformative experience. And because some of them grew up to be Eric Clapton, Ray Davis, Pete Townsend, Keith Richards. And Eric Clapton in particular recalled watching this documentary on TV. And as he said, it was such a powerful image. Bill playing as a solo acoustic performer, just him and his guitar, under a bare light bulb, with cigarette smoke curling around him as Eric Clapton and playing blues as a blues man.
Right.
And as Eric Clapton said, it was like looking into heaven.
Yeah. And we do hear that we're always looking at, and we've been looking at it in this program, and we're always looking and hearing blues, folk blues, and you see how they're both choices that Bill is making at different times, but how also they're intertwined, and how even though this is acoustic, and in this recording there's a bass as well, it sounds, but he is transmitting what you're then going to hear among both white and black musicians happen with an electric cord and speaker added to things. But you're already hearing those rhythmic choices and those stylistic choices and also the idea, all I have to say is in these chords, really, is what he's saying, isn't it? Speaking of folk, we're going to go out for this hour with Big Bill performing what I guess in the jazz world would be called a standard, but in the folk music world would be called a folk song. So tell us about this particular version and recording of John Henry before we hear it.
What you'll hear in this performance of John Henry is Big Bill's power as an acoustic player. It's a driving force. It's got tremendous momentum. This was he was hardly the only artist to perform it, but it is distinctive. It was a wonderful part of his repertoire, and some of the attack on the strings is reminiscent of some of his earlier material that he had recorded several decades before. That was characteristic of Big Bill, in being savvy enough to recognize that if he's shifting his repertoire to play for a predominantly white audience that is looking more for acoustic music, some of the material he can use is material he played in a blues setting before. It's now in a different setting, but it loses none of its power.
John Henry said to his captain, "Now, Maine ain't nothing but a Maine. Before I let your steel drill beat me down, I will die with that hammer in my hand. Yes, I'll die with that hammer in my hand. I'll die with the hammer in my hand, my Lord. Die with that hammer in my hand." John Henry said to his shaker, "Now, man, why don't you sing? I'm shaking 12 pounds from my hip on down. Why can't you hear that cold steel? Why don't you hear that cold steel ring? Why don't you hear that cold steel? Why don't you hear that cold steel ring?" John Henry hammered in the mountain, and the mountain was so high. The last word that I heard that little boy say, "Give me a cool drink of water before I, yeah, give me a cool drink of water before I die. Give me a cool drink of water before I die, my Lord. Cool drink of water before I die." She wore was red. The last word that I heard that little girl said, she said, "I'm going watch on him and fill it. Yes, I'm going watch on him and fill it. I'll cry, I'm going watch on him and fill it. Yes, I'm going watch on him and fill it." John Henry went down that railroad track with a 12-pound hammer by his side. Yes, he went down the track, but he never came back. Cause he laid down his hammer and he, yes, he laid down his hammer and he died. I'll cry, he laid down his hammer and he, yes, he laid down his hammer and he died. John Henry was a little baby you could hold in the palm of your hand. And the last thing that I heard that baby boy say, "I'm gonna be a steel driving man. Yes, I'm gonna be a little steel driving man. Out of climb, I'm gonna be a little steel driving. Yes, I'm gonna be a little steel driving man."
Taking a folk song and a folk legend and Well, that's really the point of that song in particular, particularly for a black man, is making the song his own, right? That's a great way for us to wrap up our second program on what now is officially a three-part series on Big Bill Brunzi, in particular on the book, I Feel So Good, The Life and Times of Big Bill Brunzi. For the five or eight of you who don't know the spelling, it's B-R-O-O-N-Z-Y, Brunzi. And the author of that book and our guest and co-navigator for this series is Bob Riesman, R-I-E-S-M-A-N. And as you heard, the founders of Cream, The Who, and The Rolling Stones, and then also distinguished solo careers, Eric Clapton, Pete Townsend, Keith Richards, depending upon the era, and others, were turned on to Big Bill. We explained to you why. And in fact, there is an appreciation in the book by heading up the book by none other than Pete Townsend of The Who and other projects. The book is published by University of Chicago Press in both hardcover and paperback, richly illustrated photographs that go with everything we've been talking about and more. And more comes your way next week with part three, when we look at Big Bill in Europe and then what happens back here in the States, the civil rights movement, the final years, and sadly, of course, Big Bill's death in 1958 in Hyde Park. Bob Riesman, thank you so much again for sharing the music and the words and the history and your experience with this. And I look forward to talking with you more as we do part three.
Great. Thanks, Andrew. I look forward to it, too.
In addition to Bob and the University of Chicago Press, we, of course, thank Matt DeStefano for putting the program together with us and making it sound great, as always. Our funders, Alpha Wood Foundation, Dick and Susie Kiphart, and other friends of this program. Drop us a line. You've got so many ways to be in touch with us, and you have been already about part one, which is great. There's email, rentap, that's Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P at AOL.com. You can go to WFMT.com, and right there on the critical thinking page, you can leave a comment. You can go to WFMT.com, and you can hit the chime in button and comment that way. And you can visit the newly, highly energized Facebook page that David Polk, Matt DeStefano, I, and others keep hopping for WFMT. If you're a Facebooker, just look for the picture of Big Bill, and you can leave a comment there. WFMT.com/criticalthinking is the home of the always free Critical Thinking podcast, and you can have the whole series of Big Bill programs, among other things, by going there. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll see you next week.